Morning, everybody. Today's daf in Ksuvos Chavtes. We are on the very bottom of Chavches Amud Aleph, and we're about to continue discussion of childhood memories. But before we start with childhood memories, let's thank the Lubin Foundation for sponsorship of the daf. Daf is learning Lezech Nishmat Liba Gabriel Shmuel. Finishing up the second parak this morning, and God willing, starting the third parak this morning, and with a short daf, which is today, so we have an excellent opportunity to really make up some ground and get right back to where we should be. The Mishnah tells us that, well, before we get to the Mishnah, as I mentioned yesterday, your childhood memory is not submissible evidence. It's not, you can't testify about a childhood memory. Childhood memories are just simply, they're not valid. They don't work. Again, you could talk about how memory during a child is not a mature memory. It's not a developed memory. Whatever explanation you want to give. It's, in other words, he's not a bar hachi, and therefore he can't relive and recount that which he remembered when he was a child. However, that's the rule. The Mishnah gives us all the exceptions, all the times where you can revisit a childhood memory and you can testify about a particular childhood memory. And what we're going to be doing from here until the end of the parak is we're going to explain why these are the exceptions of the rule. So, for example, yesterday we went over the idea that you can testify, that's dad's signature, that's my Rebbe's signature, that's my brother's signature. And you could do that, even though the last time you saw that signature was when you were a child. But you can go ahead and you could say, as an adult, I remember that that's how my father signed when he was a kid. That's my father's signature. So why? Meaning, how can you testify? You were a child at the time. So the Gemara said yesterday, because we're talking about kiyum shtaros, because we're talking about authenticating a document, that's a din derabanan. So on a din derabanan, the rabbis were makel, they were lenient. They allowed you to testify based on a childhood memory that you had. Good, that's what we did yesterday. And we move along. We're four or five lines down from the bottom of the Amr Chavches Amud Aleph. So a next example given in the Mishnah Zohar, you see Beplan Shiyatza Behemna Verasha Parua. You went to a chasna as a child. Okay, you don't see a lot of children at chasnas, but you went to a chasna as a child, and you're now testifying. Years later, I remember she was a basula. How do I know? Because, like we described earlier in the Masechta, there are various menhagim that the basula has at the chasna that indicates that she's a basula. I remember, he says, that she walked down the aisle. She was her hair was uncovered. She wore the hemuna, which we tried describing it earlier. But anyway, so he's recounting. So again, my taima, the Gemara says, but why? Meaning, why does he believe? Remember, what's he doing now with that testimony? With that testimony, he's going to be granting her a 200 zuz ksuva. He's going to be extracting money from one person to another. So that, and again, the rule is you can't testify about a childhood memory unless there's a counter reason, unless there's an extenuating circumstance. What's the extenuating circumstance over here? The Gemara goes on to say, "Given the Rav Nashim, but still those nisos gilui milsabamahu." So the Gemara says, "I'll tell you what it is, because most of the women who get married as a basula. So you have a rove. So really, his testimony is not really what's providing her basis of collecting the 200 zuz. It's really the rove that's providing the basis, and he's only clarifying the matter. Only clarifying the matter. What the Gemara refers to as gilui milsa. Look at Rashi. Look at the bottom Rashi and the Amud. Rashi says, "Klomar." You don't really need testimony over here. It's just right now, it's a little fuzzy, and what he's doing is he's just clarifying, he's just crystallizing. But it's referred to as Gilui Milsa. Gilui Milsa comes up again and again throughout the Gemara, meaning we kind of knew it already, but he's just sharpening the details for us that she was in fact a Besula. That she was a basula. Next case in the Mishnah, Vashaya Ishpal Yosemi Besa Sefer, Lit Bolech Obachuma, another childhood memory that he remembers. You know, my friend, I remember as kids, we went to school, and he left early in order to tovel on the mikvah so that he can eat truma. So, Vidilma Avid Kohen Hu, so the Gemara says, okay, he ate truma. That doesn't mean that he's a Kohen. In fact, we know many people are entitled to eat truma. Not many. But in other words, anyone who's connected, who is attached to, who is associated to a Kohen, is allowed to eat truma. Ashish Kohen is allowed to eat truma. And of course, Evid Kohen is allowed to eat truma. So maybe it was Evid Kohen. Although it is a little bit strange, though. Evid Kohen sitting in with him in Beit Sefer and the school. And what are they doing together in the Beit Sefer? But okay. Apparently they were. So the Gemara says, well, it's a little bit strange because Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi says he's not going to be sitting next to you in the Beis Sefer, meaning you're not allowed to teach your Eved Torah. So the Gemara says, okay, so that's going to rule out then that the person in question is an Eved.
How do you know it's not Eved Ivri?
Eved Iver can know. Eved Iver cannot eat truma. It has to be king and kaspo. It has to be an acquisition of the covenant. So an Eved Iver is not a king and kaspo. Okay. So Eved cannot. But the Eved Kanani is not going to be sitting in school because Asol Olami Torah. That time the Gemara says. But can consider the following. Learned on a brisa. Lave men a rabo she asa rabo apachos. O she niach tefillin bifnei rabo. O she karish shlosha pesukim beis hakneses. Harei zelo yetzel acheres. The Gemara in Gittin goes over a number of scenarios in which shichur, in which we talk about emancipation. What if the eved does something in front of his master, which gives us a sense that he's in fact no longer an Eved Kanani? It goes over a number of examples. Let's say, for example, the Rebbe over here doesn't mean Rebbe, meaning teacher. Rebbe over here means master, owner. So let's say he borrows money from the from his Eved. Now, it's highly unusual to begin with. The Eved Kanani doesn't have money. Mashikan Eved Kana Rabo, generally speaking, the rule is that whatever the Eved has acquired goes immediately right to his master. So that's exactly the point. Meaning it is unusual, it's highly unusual that he's going to be borrowing money from his Eved. That seems to be an act that the Eved is no longer an Eved, he's freed. Or let's say the master made his Eved an apotropos, meaning he needs a custodian, he needs a trustee, and he appoints his Eved as such. Again, that's highly unusual that an Eved Kanani is going to be serving as an apotropos. We're now on the top of Chel Chesem and Beis. Or let's say he puts on tefillin in front of his master. And Eved Kanani has no mitzvah of putting on tefillin. Eved Kanani is the same level of obligation of a woman. A woman is exempt from putting on tefillin, and Eved Kanani is so as well. And so therefore he's putting it on right in front of his master. So let's say he gets an aliyah. Right in shul. So even though these are pretty good, strong indicators that he's freed, but these by themselves are not going to be enough. But what? Okay, and again, in of itself, we could be discussing the brisa independent of our discussion. But let's just leave the brisa in the context of our discussion. What did you see in the brisa? He got an aliyah in shul. He's reading three pesukim. So the Gemara says, "Hasam dikrei eved midato ki kamin dechinag bei menag banim." So the Gemara says, "Oh, look, he wants to learn on his own. That's fine. He wants to read three pesukim in shul. That's fine. What we're saying is that to treat him like your own son, to send him to school, to give him an education like your own son, that's something that you don't do." Meaning that's what Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi was describing earlier, that the also la adam shlames avdo Torah. Meaning, certainly, if he's interested and wants to learn some Torah, that's fine on his own. That's fine, but you don't have the obligation. Although the truth of the matter is, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi says it's stronger. He says it's prohibited for you to send him to school. Okay, but still, the point being is that you will not find an eved going to get sitting in the desk next to you at the yeshiva. So the Gemara says that's highly unlikely. Therefore, the only thing that he is a Kohen. Okay. Litbo lechol b'truma. But now we get on to the next part of the Gemara, and that, of course, is what? And now, based on your testimony, he's going to eat truma. And again, how can we do that? Meaning, we're discussing a scenario where he doesn't have a chazak of being a Kohen, and the only thing that's giving him that status of being a Kohen is your testimony. It's a childhood memory. What is that? So the Gemara says, b'truma d'rabbanan. So the Gemara answers very simply, yeah. Meaning, a childhood memory that would allow him to eat truma min haTorah, no way. Meaning that we're not going to do. But a childhood memory to allow him to eat truma midrabbanan, that's fine. And again, you could circle this Rashi. Here we go again. Rashi says, what are examples of truma midrabbanan? Could go in truma's chutz la'aretz. Rashi says, the truma comes out from Eretz Yisrael. Oh, peros. Or let's say fruit. Fruit is chayav and truma midrabbanan, not min haTorah. Now, of course, even according to Rashi, excluded from the fruit are grapes and olives. They're chayv min haTorah. But outside of grapes and olives, all other fruit are only chayv and truma midrabbanan. And again, Rashi argues with the Rambam. The Rambam says that all fruit are chayv and truma min haTorah. But again, Rashi is super consistent on this point. Vishahaya cholik imanu al hagoren. Another childhood memory that said in the Mishnah that we believe him is where he says, I remember as a child that he was with us at the distribution center. We were there getting a distribution of truma. He was right there along with us. So Vidilma Eved Kohenu, the Gemara again asked the question. We're not talking about school right now. We're talking about being at the distribution center. So, Can it be that this person that he's testifying about was an Eved? So the Gemara says, Tanan Kaman da Amrein Chokin Shumala Eved. So the Gemara says, okay, but our Mishnah is subscribing to the viewpoint that you cannot do a distribution to an Eved. An Eved cannot be there to be the recipient. The Eved of a Kohen is going to be receiving his Shumah from the Kohen who got the distribution, but he himself cannot get it. Imken Rabo Imo Detanya. I'm sorry. Ela Imken Rabo Imo. Right? His Rebbe has to be together there together with him. Detanya, the Gemara Kriya quotes a Braisa. Not that long ago we saw this back in Yavamos. Ein Chokin Shumala Eved Ela Imken Rabo Imo Div Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda says that the master must be together with the Eved Kanani in order for the Eved Kanani to be receiving Truma. Rabbi Yossi Omer Yachlu Shiomer Im Kohenani Tanuli Bishvil Atmi. Vim Eved Kohenani Tanuli Bishvil Rabbi. And Rabbi Yossi says, no. A person can go there and say, look, either I'm a Kohen, therefore I'm entitled, or I'm the Eved of a Kohen, and therefore I'm entitled as well. Bilkamashal Rabbi Yehuda. And the Gemara then goes on to explain why. Why is there a discrepancy between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi in terms of whether or not an Eved Kanani can receive a distribution without his master being present? The Gemara goes on to explain. Because in the community of Rabbi Yehuda, Yomala Mitruma Liyuchsin, because if you got an allocation of Truma, that immediately presumed that you were Miyucha. And you're a Kohen and you can marry based on the idea that you're a Kohen. And Ben Kamashal Rabbi Yossi, Lo Hayumalin Michuma Liyuchsin. And in Rabbi Yossi's community, no, that didn't give you a presumptive state of being a Kohen. So therefore, if you lived in Rabbi Yossi's community, just because you received an allocation of Truma does not necessarily mean you're a Kohen Miyuchas. And now that explains the discrepancy between Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda. Tanya, that we also saw this brisa back in Yavamos, Amar Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Yossi. Mi amai lo yadoti lo heyadati. So Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Yossi says, you know, I never gave testimony. Meaning, it's obviously to give testimonies of a hefty responsibility. You have to know what you're talking about. You have to be confident. You have to be sure. And he says, and I never did in Pamachas Heyadati. And one time I gave testimony. You know how the story is going to end. The one time I gave testimony. And what happened is that I saw someone receiving a distribution of Truma. I therefore assumed, okay, he's a Kohen. And it turns out he wasn't a Kohen. Turns out that he was only the Eved of a Kohen. So based on the one time that I give testimony in my lifetime, turns out that I elevated an Eved Kohen to a Kohen. So halu sakadatcha. So the Gemara says, now wait one second. Did that really happen? Meaning, aren't tzaddikim afforded an extra level of protection from a Kadosh Baruch Hu, where you're not going to have these kinds of calamities befall tzaddikim, where they're going to refer to an Eved as an Eved Kohen as a Kohen, and in other words, and it doesn't Kadosh Baruch Hu protect the tzaddikim? Ela bichul alos Eved Lekohen Alpi. So it's not that it actually happened, but he was ready. He was prepared. And he was ready to make that very big mistake of giving an Eved Kohen the status of a Kohen. So, Chaz Basar Derav Yosef, Chaz Basar Derav Yehuda. And the Gemara goes on to explain. What was the mistake? What's the source of this mistake? He was in the community of Rav Yossi. And I remember, in Rav Yossi's community, Kohen and Eved Kohen received the distribution. Because it didn't mean anything. It just meant All getting truma meant is you can eat truma, but it doesn't mean you're a Kohen. And then he went down to the community of Rav Yehuda and reported, you know, so-and-so received truma. On the community of Rav Yehuda, it's a big deal to receive truma. Meaning it's not just for those who can eat truma, it's for only Kohanim. So that was the source of the mistake that was made. The mistake was giving him yichus, meaning the eating of the truma wasn't a mistake. He's entitled to eat truma. He's an Eved Kohen. The mistake. Okay, agreed. But the okay. All right, back to the Gemara again. Childhood memories are admissible. So he testifies, you know, I remember as a kid, so this area was the Beis HaPras. Beis HaPras we've gotten over a number of times. Mishnayos and Oalos, which we've also gotten over, tells us that there are different types of Beis HaPras. It's not just one type of Beis HaPras. But right now we're describing what I would call the classic Beis HaPras. Classic because usually this is what the Gemara, this is the one that the Gemara deals with, and that is that you had a cemetery plot, and it was a terrible accident, and someone plowed over the plot. And so, you know, took the plow, took the till, and just went right through the grave and took the remains, the human remains, and kind of spread them out all over the field. So that area is called the Beis HaPras. The word pras means portion, and the concern is that little chips of bone have been now spread out throughout the entire field because of the plowing. And so within a perimeter of 100 amos, so one has to now assume that this area has tuma. As Rashi over here points out, what's going to happen is the Kohen's going to walk and he's going to step on a bone, move a bone, and that makes a person tame. Now remember, with bones, by the way, unless you have the full or the majority of the skeletal structure, bones you only give off tuma only through magan masa, only through contact and through carrying. Tumas Ohel is only when you have either kezias of the actual human remains or you have the majority of the skeletal structure. But just for a bone chip, there's no Tumas Ohel. Okay, but still, that's just
kezias returned to flesh?
Yes, correct. Absolutely correct. So, right. So, my time, so again, so why are we extending this person credibility based on a child's memory? So the Gemara says, Beis HaPras de Rabbanan. Because the din of the Beis HaPras is a din de Rabbanan, it's only based on a concern, it's a chshash. The rabbis made a decree based on a concern, and that's a din de Rabbanan, and therefore with room to be lenient. And the Gemara gives other examples. Again, this is classic Gemara. The Gemara goes over these examples a number of times. Amar Avinam Shmuel Menafech Adam, Beis HaPras Vaholech. A person can blow his way through the Beis HaPras. In other words, if in a more modern visualization, if you have like one of those leaf blowers, so you can like, you know, kind of blow your, I know they didn't have that back then. I know it's a little bit anachronistic, but still, you get the basic idea. You can move your way through the Beis HaPras. In other words, because what's the concern? You're going to hit a bone chip. But if you blow your way through, so then you're fine. Rav Yehuda Barami Mishmei de Rav Yehuda Amar Beis HaPras Nida Shtar. Let's say there's been a path that's been shredded upon. Okay, so it's been cleared. That path has been cleared. You can walk through that path, even though that path takes you right through a Beis HaPras. My Taima Yef Shal Etzalasim Kesaora Elish Nidash Beregel. Remember, we're worried about bone chips, and even by bone chips, you need a certain amount of bone chip. And if the path has been walked over again and again, so there's not going to be a bone chip on that path anymore. So you see that even if it's a Beis HaPras, there are certain kulas, or certain leniencies. So the Gemara says, same thing over here. If a person says, it's a childhood memory, this is not the area of the Beis HaPras, we believe him. Another childhood memory that we went over in the Mishnah is that he's talking about Chum. We only went to this point on Shabbos, we don't go past that point. In other words, we know that on Shabbos and on Yontif, a person's not allowed to walk beyond a certain perimeter. It's called Chum Shabbos, 2,000 amas beyond the city limit, or if you're not within the city, 2,000 amas of your Makom Shvisa. So what he's testing... They could. Just in other words, the point being, the Gemara's got to, you know, Gemara's just going to make the point that Tchum is the Rabbanan, and okay, and let's see this inside. Kasavet Tchum and the Rabbanan, again, Tchum, the din of Tchum is a din de Rabbanan, and so therefore we're believing him, we're extending him credibility, because anyway, he's testifying about a din de Rabbanan. But to give a person land entitlement, land ownership, based on a childhood memory, the Gemara says that no, that he won't do. And my time, afuki mamona la mafkinan, and the Gemara gives a very simple explanation. Because by giving somebody land entitlement, so if you're giving one person land, that means you're taking it away from somebody else. No, you can't do that. You cannot extract money from one person to another based on a testimony that is based on a childhood memory. Tana Rabban, the Gemara.
But
Kiyum Shtaris is taking out money, but again, the star is there. The star is signed. We're only talking about the authentication of the signatures. That's a din de Rabbanan. Okay. Tana Rabbanan. Neman atina glomar kachamar liaba mishiv chazu tora mishiv chazu tamea. I'm sorry. Thank you. Neman atina glomar kachamar liaba mishpacha zu tora mishpacha zu tamea. Tora u tamea sakadacha. The Gemara says, what does that mean? Tora tamea. That's not the right terminology. Ela mishpacha zu tshera u mishpacha zu psula. U shachlanim biksaso shabais ploni. Hold on a second. Let me pause for just a moment. So, with just a minor correction of the Braisa. So, you could say this mishpach is good, this mishpach is no good. Not Torah Temeah. So, that's not Shaykh. But, in other words, this one's kosher, this one's not. Usha achlanu b'kitzatzo shabbas ploni. And we ate the kitzatza of so-and-so. Now, if that's a word that you're not familiar with, that's fine, because the Gemara itself, in just a moment, is going to wonder, what are we talking about? Visha, you know, molichim chala matans l'ploni kohen al yedei atzmi. So, or for example, we brought challah and matanos. Challah, of course, is the portion of dough that you take off to give to the kohen, status of truma, and matanos zor lechayiv keva, the three parts of an animal, of every animal that needs to go to a kohen. And I remember as a kid, we used to bring it to this kohen. Now, in the testimony, he's got to say that I delivered it myself. And not through another messenger. However, even though all the childhood memories are admissible, but you cannot have a childhood memory of the time before you converted. Meaning a childhood memory before he converted. But what you cannot do is you cannot give somebody a land entitlement. Because by doing that, you're going to be taking money away from somebody else that you can't do. Now the Bryce ends off with a very vague disputant. Meaning Rav Yochan ben Broka says, no, he is believed. Okay, period. Ad kan divrei habraisa, and to which the Gemara says, "How did that braisa end?" Rav Yochan ben Broka says, "No, I disagree." On what point? Rav Yochan ben Broka, haya ilei masei fafuke mamonuhu. There's no way that Rav Yochan ben Broka could be arguing on the last point of the braisa, giving land or taking land away from somebody else based on a childhood memory. There's no way that he can argue with that. That's afuke mamona. That's extracting money from somebody. Amoti mechaver alavaraya. That you can't contest ownership unless you have absolute proof. Ela Aresha. So the Gemara says what he must be arguing with is an earlier point on the Braisa. Which earlier point? The Kulim Imayo, the Kochav, and his Gari, Evan Mishachri, Ein Ne'emanim. Rav Yochan ben Broka, Omer Ne'emanim. So it must be that he's arguing on the point of a Jew having a childhood memory before he converted. Now the Gemara goes on to explain what's the Nekudas HaMachlokas. Tanakam HaSavakem Dovei Kochavimu Lo Havadayik. And the Tanakam's opinion is as follows. Look, at the time he was not Jewish. He does not have sensitivity towards Halacha. And why should he? He's not Jewish. He's not. He doesn't have to follow the Halacha. In certain areas that's acceptable, but over here we're talking about creating a yichus, creating a status for a family. I don't.
And he knows what he's doing.
Right, but anyway, but the point is that as a non-Jew, look, if you're not bound by these halachas, you just simply don't have a sensitivity towards them. You don't have an awareness about them. So the Tanakhama's position is, look, it wasn't even a childhood memory. Meaning, you can't expect him to remember something that he has no awareness about. And Rav Yochan ben Broka Savar came to Daita Leigurim Meidak Havadayik. And Rav Yochan ben Broka says, yeah, I agree, but I disagree. What I agree with, of course, you're right, he's not bound by the halacha, but here's what I disagree about. Obviously, he was thinking about conversion. Conversion doesn't take a day. It's a process. It's a long process. So maybe what he's remembering is that at a time in his life when he was considering conversion, so then he became much more sensitive and aware of these halachos. And maybe then he has extended that credibility. Okay, period. Adkan, that's the machlokus between the Tanakhama and Rav Yochan ben Broka. And finally, to finish off the perek, we just end off with one question, and that's my kitzatza. We said at the end of this perek that there's a childhood memory that he's There's a childhood memory that he's ringing up, that he's bringing up, about how we used to eat the kitzatza. What's that? So my kitzatza, that's the Gemara's question to Tana Rabban. The Gemara gives an answer. Let's say one of the brothers married a woman he should not have married. Now, not exactly clear who he married that's inappropriate. But I don't think the Braisa means, we just didn't think it was a good shidduch. My sense is Rashi doesn't comment,
but my sense is,
I don't know. I mean, look, I don't know, but my sense is that we're talking about an isser. Okay. So what the family does is as follows: they make a scene. Okay, it's a very, very interesting minug. I don't think the Gemara describes this anywhere else in Chas. But they make a scene, and that is the following. They take a barrel of fruit, they bring it into the middle of the street, they break it right in the middle of the street. And they make a declaration that that our brother married a woman he should not have married. And now they're going to produce children that are blemished. Now again, I'd love over here a little more clarification of what Isser are we talking about? Are we talking about with the children of Mamzerim? Very vague, very very unclear. Ba'u kulachem dugma. Everyone here have a sample, meaning, in other words, it's a bizarre scene, but that's exactly the point, right? It's Pesach is coming up. It's kind of like do strange things so that people will remember. The kids will look. The kids will say, "What's going on over here?" Here also, brother did something that was totally inappropriate. So do this in the middle. So in the middle of the street, so that everyone remembers, like that was weird. Exactly. Meaning it'll etch a memory in your head. And not only that, but the child can have a memory of such an event, and that would be an admissible memory that would be taken into account. That is the end of the second paragraph of the Masechta. Okay, good. We start today, today's daf, and that is the beginning of the third perek. Beginning of the third perek is certainly going to be an indelicate discussion that we're going to have, or a very delicate discussion that we're going to have, and that is, we're going to talk about rape and seduction. I remember the third perek is extremely popular in the yeshivas, meaning that when the yeshivas learn Masechta Ksuvos, so they're going to be learning one of two perakim. They're going to either be learning the first or the third. Now, it doesn't have to be that way. They could choose other parakim, but these are the parakim that are typically learned. I remember, Hedy, I remember as a child. It wasn't a child. My years in Yeshiva University, so my Rebbe was Reb Ron Shmigel, Kosh Baruch Hu should give him a refuah shlema. So I remember him saying to us, we learned the third parak of Ksuvos together. And he said to us, "Boys, I want you to try this at home. Try to explain to your parents what you're learning in yeshiva. You know, you're learning about rape, you're learning about seduction. It's strange, it's bizarre. Not that the Torah addresses that. That's not strange and bizarre, but this is like the topic that's chosen in the yeshivas. So Hedy, your question is obviously a good one. Why are we learning this? What's going on over here? So it's as you'll see in the first couple blot of this masech of this perek, the Gemara here is going to be touching on some very basic Shas topics. Now I know it comes up in a very awkward circumstance, meaning these Shas topics are not necessarily related to rape and seduction. We're going to be talking in the next couple days about kimle midirabimine, about what happens when a person has two punishments, and how you do not punish somebody twice over. We're going to be talking about whether or not kimle midirabimine applies to capital crime, whether it applies to spiritual death as opposed to actual capital death. In other words, there's going to be a lot of basic discussions that talk about judicial system, judicial process, and so it therefore becomes like just basic discussions of Shas topics, abstract topics, things that are very easy to conceptualize. And I know, in other words, if you forget about what we're talking about, they're very conceptual topics. They're very enjoyable, very meaty topics. That's why they're popular. But in the context of rape and seduction, it's a little bit strange. But that's the context in which it talks about. Let me just give some brief comments before we start with the perek over here. Okay, first of all, I'm sure everybody knows, but let me just go over the basics. There are three developmental stages for a woman. A woman, from the time that she's born until she's 12 years of age, she's a ketana, she's a minor. She's not chayav in mitzvos, and by a woman, not only is she not chayav in mitzvos, but also dad has certain rights over her as a ketana. As a ketana, dad has the ability to marry her off, dad has the ability to sell her. Now, I know that doesn't speak to our modern society, and it certainly does not sound like... doesn't sound pleasant, But in the context of our Gemara, you'll see time and again, the selling of the daughter is for the purposes of creating a future marriage and for the protection of the daughter. It's in other words, you have to contextualize it. It's not done just for the sale and for the money. It's done to provide for her future and to protect her. But okay, but. Again, just dealing with the clinical Gemara. So when she's a katana, so she's not chayav mitzvahs, and dad has certain rights to her. Okay, then her bas mitzvah. She's 12 years of age. Now she's an adult. But in the developmental stages of a woman, I'm not talking about the physical development, although they're connected, but I'm talking about the halachic development from the time that she's bas mitzvah until 6 months later, she's what's called a nara. Okay, Nara, loosely translated, just simply means that she's a young woman. But Nara, halachically translated, means that we're talking about the six-month stage from being 12 to being 12 and a half. And then after 12 and a half years of age, she's now a Bulgari, she's a full-fledged adult. That Nara stage is the trickiest of stages, where on one hand, she is an adult, she's chayav in mitzvos. On the other hand, she still has her father's she has certain rights of her father that are still upon her. In other words, she's still connected to her father. It's not until she's a bogeres where she becomes a fully independent halachic entity, if you will. Okay, that's just basic points number one. Okay, now let's talk about what happens if, God forbid, a man rapes a woman. A man rapes a woman, obviously it is a crime. It's not my purpose over here to talk about how bad a crime it is. It's obviously a heinous crime. We're just going to deal with it from an extraordinarily legal perspective, and that now that it's a crime, so what is the punishment for such a crime? So first and foremost, before we learn a mission together, so let's just say the following. In other words, it's battery. Meaning that it's be no different than assault, than a man assaulting another man. When a man assaults another man, so the eighth parak of Bava Kama says that you have to pay for all the damages that you've done. Including those damages are the actual damage itself, in other words, reparation for the actual damage itself, plus the medical bills, plus workers' comp, plus embarrassment, and missed one, and plus the pain. Okay, five different payments that you have to pay. So when you assault another person, so first and foremost, when the man rapes a woman, so that's assault. That, in other words, and that's nezek haguf, and you have to pay all the damages that are associated with assault. That's number one. Number two, the Torah says that when a man rapes a woman, so he's got to marry her. Now, as we're going to learn in our perek, she's got to want in. In other words, it's obviously not against her will. It's only going to be with her will. A woman would agree to such a marriage. So, and again, in our day and age, it's hard to imagine. But in the time of the Gemara, however, in earlier days, so it, maybe she'll understand that he'll provide for her, he'll protect her. In other words, granted that what he did to her was heinous, but still, in other words, she may ultimately agree. And the Torah then puts the burden of responsibility on him. I mean, the Torah says if you're going to act in such a way, so now one of the responsibilities you're going to take on now is that if she's in agreement, you're going to be married to her. Furthermore, he has no right to divorce her. He cannot divorce her. Meaning, unlike a wife that he chooses, and that he, you know, they go through the regular kedushin, but over here, because the Torah says, because he raped her, so therefore married and no option of divorce. And finally, on top of all that, also there's knas. Knas is punitive. There's a punitive fine that's associated with it as well. In other words, in addition to, make this point as clear as possible, in addition to all the regular damages that he pays her for the assault and battery. That's not a fine. That's the compensatory damages that you paid for because you assaulted, because that was battery. But in addition to that, also there's a fine of chamishim kesef. Chamishim kesef, 50 silver, which is, by the way, the same as 200 zuz, that he has to pay. What we're going to be learning in our mission is the following. You could have made the following presumption. In fact, the Gemara in today's Amud Beis is going to describe. You could have said, look, in terms of the payments for assault and the damages and the compensatory damages, it goes without saying. He's always going to be on the hook for that, like any other damages. But in terms of the knas, in terms of the fine, maybe you might have thought that he's only going to be on the hook for the fine only if he can marry her. Let's say, for example, we're going to go over a number of them in just a moment. Let's say, for example, he is ma'anis, a woman who he cannot marry. Because the Torah says he can't marry her. So then, one of the penalties of a ma'anis is no longer applicable. So I might have thought, well, if he can't marry her, he doesn't have to pay the knas. What we're going to learn together on the Mishnah is that these two halachas are not connected. You can disconnect these two halachas, where even though he cannot marry her, he still has to pay her knas.
Is it a positive commandment to marry?
Yes. Included in the positive commandment of marrying her also is the negative prohibition of not being able to divorce her. But again, that's exactly the point. Is that that's the chiddush of the Mishnah? Is that despite the fact that he can marry her, he still has to pay kenas? Okay, elu na'aros sheyesh lehem kenas. These are the na'aros that have a kenas. And again, the word na'ara over here, just speaking strictly in the halachic sense, means that she's between 12 and 12 and a half years of age. So, habala mamzeres valnasin balakusis. A man forces himself upon either a mamzeres, a woman who is a mamzeres, meaning she was a product of an illicit union, or she was an asina. An asina, Rashi over here explains, is somebody who comes from the Givonim, who is asura lekahal, prohibited to marry into the congregation. Rashi says, David gazar aleim kedamina b'yavamos. David made exera upon her, as we learn back in Yavamos. Al shem v'yinem Yoshua chotvei etzim v'shoavei mayim. Okay, so what we talked about this back in Yavamos, how they were part of the seven Canaanite nations. They made a pact with us. We didn't know they were part of the seven Canaanite nations. We agreed to the pact. We even though the treaty was made under false pretenses, we're still bound by the treaty of not killing them. On the other hand, they are asur l'avobikal, and then it does sound a little bit strange because it's a rabbinic decree, and they're biblically prohibited to marry into the congregation. How exactly does that work? There's a lengthy tosus over here. It's the first tosus of the perek. In the meantime, however, we're going to get to the basic point of the Mishnah. So, habala mamzeres valnasin valakusis. Kusis is one of the groups that were brought in by Sancheirev during the Bais Rishon, during the first temple period, where after having dispersed the 10 northern tribes, so he replaced them with a group from a land in Bavel called Kuta. They're therefore from that point forward going called the Kutim. I think in modern terminology they're referred to as Samaritans. But either way, the point being that their conversion to Yiddishkeit, they did end up converting to Yiddishkeit, but the Navi describes, however, that it may not have been a valid conversion. They were attacked by lions. That's why you're going to see the terminology of Geri Arayos, right? They were converted, but because of the lions. They came into Eretz Yisrael, they were over to Avodah Zarah, and therefore the lions attacked them. Therefore, they decided, quote unquote, decided that that maybe they should stop practicing their idolatry. They took on Yiddishkeit. Is their conversion a good one or not? Constantly debated throughout Shas whether the conversion was sincere or not sincere. Our Mishnah is working obviously with the opinion that you cannot marry her. So, if these are the women, Amanzeres and Sina Kusis, or Habala Giyor Vashvuya Vala Shivcha Shniftiv Shinishkar Vishnishtachru, Pchusus Mi B'no Shanim V'yomechad, or let's say he is Me'anes, a convert, a woman who was taken captive, or a woman who was a slave who was emancipated, and these events occurred before she turned the age of 3. And again, this goes back to what we discussed earlier, where even if they were violated, but if it was done before the age of 3, besulos chozrim, so that does not affect their besula, they're still going to be besulos. So these are so far we've gone through two different sets of cases. Either the man is ma'anes a woman that he's not allowed to marry, or a man is ma'anes a woman who may have been already previously had relations, but did so before the age of 3, so therefore, for sure, still has the besula. Or habalachos avalachos avivachos imo, or a man has relations with his sister, his father's sister, his mother's sister, alachos ishto, his wife's sister, valishos achiv, or the wife of his brother, valishos achi aviv, or the wife of his uncle. Again, a whole series of women that he's not allowed to marry. Now, mind you, by the way, just got to keep this in mind. Meaning, we're in the context of our discussion, he has to pay her a knas. That's the entire point of our Mishnah. The one singular point of our Mishnah is in all these cases he has to pay her kanas. Now keep in mind, you're paying her kanas only if you ruptured her basulin. So in many of these cases, almost all these cases, she was a basula. What about the fact that she was your brother's wife or your uncle's wife? Right? So Rashi points out over here is that meaning, what does that mean she was the brother's wife? Meaning that they went through Erusin, but they didn't go through Nisuin. If she went through Nisuin, so then that means that she is now, she was not a Basula. So again, that means then that you're not going to be paying a Knas. Again, just for the, you know, at the risk of being repetitive. Obviously, still, it's a crime, and you're going to have to pay all those damages. But in terms of kanas, you're not going to have to, you're not going to pay, because the kanas is only in lieu of the fact that she's no longer a basula. Al eshes achiv, al eshes achiv, al hanida, and also a man is ma'anes anida. Yesh lehem kanas. In all these cases, there is in fact a kanas. Afa pishain bihi kares. The Mishnah says, but nevertheless, there's going to be a kanas. Now, it's true. With all these women, there's an iser kares in the process of the bia. Nevertheless, that iser kares is not going to take away your financial obligation of having to pay the kanas. And again, this is going to lead us to, we're not going to talk about this today, but we're going to start with this in tomorrow's daf. It's going to lead us to the discussion of, we have a principle in halacha of kamlei b'derabamineh, that if a person in one action has multiple punishments he's looking at, you only give him the harsher of the two, and you relieve him from the lesser of the two, the principle of kamlei b'derabamineh. And the Mishnah over here is articulating the point that we'll say kamlei b'derabamineh if the two punishments are corporal punishments, punishments enforceable by Beis Din. But if one punishment is min hashamayim and the other one is min ha'adam, so then the min hashamayim punishment, in our case, kares, is not going to remove the financial obligation that he has in the act that he did. The point the Mishnah is making is that it's an Isser Karis. And still, he's going to be Chayav Kenas. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, the Gemara is bothered by a very simple question, and that is, the way the Mishnah is structured, it sounds like, if a man is Ma'anis with these women, he has to bear Kenas. Every one of the women that we describe in the Mishnah are Psulos, they're disqualified. And what does that mean? That if he's ma'anis a woman who has no psul whatsoever, he's not obligated to pay her kanas. You could read the Mishnah that way, but that's an impossible reading. That's untenable. And the Gemara goes right to that. So the Gemara says that when we say that these na'aros psulos have kanas, it means not psulos versus ksheros, but elo na'aros psulos sheishlam kanas abalam amzer falanasin valakutsis. It means, our Mishnah is telling us, it goes without saying that if a man's ma'anis a woman and she has no psul whatsoever, obviously, it's a pasuk in the Torah, he has to pay her kanas. What our Mishnah means is that our Mishnah is giving us a chiddush. Even though he's ma'anis women that he cannot marry, still, he has to pay her kanas. Now the Gemara goes on to describe the next word of the Mishnah, and that is the word na'aros. These are the na'aros that he has to pay kenas. Now, na'aros, meaning, and what? If he's ma'anis a katana, he doesn't have to pay kenas? The Gemara says that's correct. Meaning, our Tana subscribes to that viewpoint. So, katana mi basi yom echad v'ad shetav yishtei saros yesh la mecher v'ein la kenas. Again, we go back to what I said before we started the perek. There are three stages to a woman. From birth until 12, she's a katana. From 12 to 12 and a half, she's a nara. For 12 and a half and onward, she's a bogeris. The way that Rebbe Meir is going to organize this information is that when she's a katana until she's 12 years of age. Now, to be fair, he says shtei sa'aras, but we're going to assume right now that shtei sa'aras is synonymous with 12 years of age. Yesh la mecher ve'en la kenas. She can be sold by the father, meaning father at that stage of her life has rights over her and has the ability to sell her. However, in La Knas, but there's no Knas, meaning that also during that same stage, if a man is Ma'anisir, so he's got to, again, it's a crime, and he's got to pay all the damages, but he does not pay Knas. And from the point of Shtei Sa'aris until she becomes a Bogeris, meaning during that 6-month period, Yesh La Knas, Ve'en La Mecher. So then, inverted. Now she will receive a kanas if in fact she's an anusa, but no mecher, meaning father loses at that point the right to sell the divrei Rabbi Meir. So in other words, we're just simply saying these halachas are not connected, they're just simply mutually exclusive. Meaning that from birth until 12, dad has rights over her, and she's not going to be receiving kanas in the case of ones, and then from 12 and 12 and a half, flip. Dad lose, no longer has the right to sell her, and if she's on a nusa during that point, she's going to receive kanas. Shaya Rabbi Meir Omer, kol makom sheish mecher in kanas, v'chol makom sheish kanas in mecher. Okay, and just that these two halachas are mutually exclusive from one another. The Chachamim Omrim, Kitana, Mibal Shalshanim, Yom Echad, V'ashiti Bagar, Yesh La Knas. A Kitana from 3 years of age until she's a Bagaris will be receiving a Knas if God forbid she's an Anusa. So Knas in Mechal. Now, just the Gemara just jumps on that last point of the Chachamim right away. What does that mean? It means Knas, but not Mechal? So the Gemara says, no, of course not. Lo, Ema Af Knas. It just simply means that there's overlap. Meaning that when the father can sell her, during her stage from birth until 12, she's also at that point in time also entitled to the kanas payment as well. Okay. Here the Gemara on top of Chavtes and Beis, here the Gemara spells out what really is the Chiddush of the Mishnah. Meaning the Mishnah is telling us that she's going to be receiving a kanas. She was an anusa. She's entitled to all the regular compensatory payments, and she's also going to get a kanas as well. And why should that be? We can't marry her. Ve'amai ikrei kam v'losi alisha isha ru'uyalo. So Amar Ish Lakish. The Gemara is going to answer this now. To give away the Gemara's answer, it's going to be gzeiros hakosav, meaning or drashas, meaning you're right. One could have easily have attached the two halachas. That kanas is really connected to marriage. And if he can't marry, he doesn't bear kanas. But basically, it's going to be a gzeiros hakosav. It's a limud. Now, the way the Gemara is going to present to us this information, it sounds like there's going to be a machlokas of how we darshan. Ultimately, when all said and done, it's not really a machlokas. They're really speaking to one large drasha. And each one of them is just giving a perspective of how the drasha works. Amrish Lakish Nara Nara Hana Ara. Now there are two parshiyos in the Torah. I should have also pointed this out in the introduction, but it's okay. I'll say it now. And that is that the Torah describes two different types of a man and a woman being together, but not in the context of marriage. Number one is ones. Ones, which is described in Parshas Kiseitse. A man rapes a woman. A second time is pitui, and that's seduction. Seduction is where a man seduces a woman, and she was not interested, but after some cajoling and some sweet-talking, so eventually she capitulates. So that's what's called pitui. So in both of those cases, the Torah describes both of them. Once in Parshas Kiseitse, that's the ones, and the other pitui is described in Parshas Mishpatim. So the Gemara over here points out that we have psukim in both, and extra words. Na'ara, na'ara, ha-na'ara. Now the truth of the matter is it says na'ara twice in Parshas Kiseitse. The one time it says it with a hey, so we're gonna darsh chad legufe wants to tell us that a nara is entitled to kanas v'chalasui chay v'lavin, and wants to tell us that even if she is a chay v'lavin, that there's a Torah prohibition of marrying her v'chalasui chay v'krisus, and one is coming to include even chay v'krisus as well. Rav Papa Amar Basula Basula Habasulos. This is now the pasuk in Parshas Mishpatim, where the Torah there describes pitui, seduction, chal gufe, chal asui chay v'lav, chal asui chay v'krisos. And again, it says the word besula and says ha besulos, and one of those words is extraneous, in addition to the fact that the hay in the front of the word is also extraneous, so therefore allows for two different drushes. V'raf papa ma'itam alam ha'kareish lakish, so the Gemara now goes over its standard, why didn't each one like the other drusha? So, ha'umi bai lelechada bai damar bai ba'ala umesa pater. If, let's say, a man has relations with a woman and she dies, so he's exempt from having to pay the kenas. Shenema v'nasan la'aviyah na'ara, because the pasuk says he gives the father of the na'ara, la'aviyah na'ara v'lo la'avi mesa. Father of the woman, but not the father of a woman who's no longer alive. So in other words, the kanas payment is only going to be when she's still alive. Reish Lakish, my time, Allah, like Rav Papa. Why doesn't Reish Lakish hold like Rav Papa? When we buy Leila Gezerah Shava. Detanya. Rav Papa needs it for Gezerah Shava. Kesef Yishkol Kamara Basilis. This is Parshas Mishpatim. The Torah describes that he has to pay Moar Basilos when he seduces a woman. She is it. Kamara Basilis. Moar Basilis Kezeh. As Rashi points out over here. Meaning that what we're doing is we're equating certain halachas of rape and seduction. Number one, the coin that you have to use as a shekel in order to pay. Number two, the amount. In both cases, both in rape and seduction, the kanas payment has to be 50 shkalim. Now, very shlakish, my nami mi baile lechadabai, vera papa nami mi baile lechzereshava. Now the Gemara points out, these halachas are not points of dispute. Both Rav Papa and Abaye agree to these halachas. And now that that's true, so then where are we right now? We have extra words, but truth be told, is that these drushas, which are derived from the extra words, are agreed to by both Amarayim. Ella. So the Gemara says, and with this we'll finish. Ella Shisa Kreitziva. So the Gemara says, okay, when we're all said and done, they're not arguing. They are all just looking at the same point from different perspectives. Nara, nara, ha, nara. Besula, besulos, ha, besulos. So now we have a pool of six different words. Trela gufai, two of them are telling us the basic halacha. Chalek adabai v'chalek zereshava. And then two more are telling us the halachas that we just learned. Kenas is only when the woman's still alive. And the Gzeirah Shavah that connects the two parshios, and he also lutrei, leaving now two chad lasui chayv alavim v'chad lasui chayv ekrisos, and wants to tell us that a man is ma'anes a chayv elav, he has to pay kenas. A man is ma'anes chayv ekrisos, he has to pay kenas. Period. Okay, Adkan, that takes us to the beginning of the third parak, and tomorrow we open up with the discussion of Kimlei B'Derabim Minei, a quote-unquote, a classic discussion in Shas, really the reason why this parak is such a popular parak in the yeshivas, and we'll pick it up tomorrow.